Last time we followed a kind of a theme through chapter 2, or the last part of chapter 2 that we had not yet looked at previously. We'd been gone a couple of weeks, and before I forget, let me mention, I will not be here next week, because it will be the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. Maybe others would not be able to be here too, but next Tuesday, Sharon and I are leaving for North Carolina, and we'll be up there until Saturday morning. And the plan is to leave Saturday morning in order to come back in time to do Vespers. So that's our plan, but I won't be here Wednesday. Now, I have a temptation to go back over chapter 2 with a second theme that we definitely did not touch on. Or we could just continue, you know, moving right along from chapter 67. But, see, Jim, you weren't able to be here last week. And, and you weren't here last week. So let me go ahead and give in to that temptation and hope that it's a good thing. And so I have a theme to follow through that we did not pick up last week. So what we did last week is on the recording. So let me try to do this as efficiently as I can. I've come up with a special blue mark, never used before, with a special little flower, you know, sign to identify those points that follow this particular theme. This is an innovation. Numbered flowers. I've never done that before. This is not a difficult book in most ways. It's more or less easy to see what he means by moving toward others in a way that is compliant in an unhealthy way, moving against others, moving away from others. These are things that all of us do. Horney says that one of the three, generally we learn during our lifetime that one of them works in most cases better for us than the others, and so we have a tendency to rely on that one. But all of us do all these things all the time. And it's not like using these strategies to have a sense of wholeness or being able to function with others, it's not like, oh, this is a sin, stop doing it. It's not that kind of thing. This analysis that he's presenting to us is intended to give us some insight into ourselves, into what goes on in ourselves. So that, I think, is something that I think I've repeated that more than once. And he repeats himself an awful lot, too, so maybe it's a good thing. At any rate, page 35, the heading, just the heading. With true love, we take a correct position before others. So the idea here is that there are ways that we try to gain love or show love to others that are not true love that God always shows to us and that we are meant to have for others based on our love of God. None of us function like that. Saints do, but it's not like, I do and you don't. No, we all don't. So true love, we're moving toward it. It's like theosis. We don't have to say, well, I have theosis and you don't. You know, don't have to worry about that. All of us are, I think we're probably pretty much in the same boat here. But there is such a thing as true love. It is God's divine love for us. And it is possible for us to participate in that love by humility and a right stance before God, not even moving toward God, which, what does that mean? It means not using God, not being attached to God. In other words, not attaching God in a sense to ourselves as this is God who is going to help me be independent of God, which is kind of ironic. But, you know, sometimes we will go to God and we'll ask him, give me these things that I need in order to function in the world so that I have a sense of my own strength and autonomy, because I need this. God will not answer that prayer, because basically we're asking God to make us independent of him, attaching ourselves to him in obeisance, but not in humility, in an unhealthy way. You know, I'm willing to bow down before you. Please give me the things that I need in order to be able to function independent of others and you, basically, in the world. We could almost imagine the Pharisee asking for that, and then if he feels like he's functioning adequately in the world and he's doing all the things that he ought to do, then he can thank God. And the fact of the matter is, he doesn't know God at all. He's functioning on his own. So there is something else, a true love, not a maneuver where we try to use God or get him to make us independent of him. There is something else, and that something else is a true love. With true love, we take a correct position before others, a correct position before God in humility, and a correct position before others. So that's the first point. Next page, 36. Next heading, page 37. Moving toward people is this attachment. So we move toward God, try to glom onto God in a way that we expect him to do for us something that will make us strong and independent of others in the world, and actually God. Elder Simeon says this is spiritual suicide. God is not going to answer in that prayer, because life is to live from God humbly, recognizing that this other way of wanting to be independent of others, independent of God, solitary, in isolation, on our own, it's suicide, because God created us to be one with others. We can't be isolated in that way. So next point, page 38, one must not even be attached to God. I already tried to speak to that. One must not be even be attached to God as an abandonment of inner stillness, that stable, humble place where, as Metropolitan Jonah would say, we're not resentful, we're not reacting. See, resentment, reaction, that's very similar to moving against or moving toward, you know, others, trying to establish ourselves, being resentful, reacting to things that other people say in order to protect ourselves. But instead, there is that alternative of keeping inner stillness, okay? So if we try to attach God to ourselves, or ourselves to God, and it's like, you and me, God, we're going to make this deal. I'll make you a deal, God. Do this for me, and I will worship you. That is an abandonment of the reality of our actual relationship to God. That, I think, is what he's saying. So it's an abandonment of inner stillness to use God, moving away from the way we ought to be with God, our proper stance toward God, toward using God as a self-affirming crutch. I think that helps. God is not going to encourage us to try to use him as a crutch to be able to get through life without humility, without repentance, without turning toward him, knowing that he is the source of our life. Rather than doing that, asking him for something that is going to help us in a worldly kind of way. We must approach God with humility, top of 39. Point number four, running through the chapter trying to pick up this thread, which will come clear in the end, I hope. Page 41, a compulsive pursuit of the other is the kind of thing that we can do in that unhealthy compliance way. We can do that even with God, Elder Simeon is saying. In other words, we can be compulsively pursuing God's helping us to be independent of others and actually him. And it's a compulsion. You know, remember, anything that is unhealthy, neurotic, to use the term that Elder Simeon is using, along with Hornai, is something that we are essentially not aware of. Something that is largely unconscious. We have a compulsion to act in certain kinds of ways, and the effort, the spiritual effort that we're trying to make, is to become more conscious, less compelled. The urge to comply with others in an unhealthy way, or move against them, or protect ourselves in fear of them. We can do that even with God. There is a healthy way, a right way, to have a stance before God and others. That's the central point here. Next point, page number 44, top of 44. The person who has a compulsive inner tendency is in a position to be blinded and not see even in himself anything good that he has and that the other doesn't have. In other words, you don't see how you can help one another, work one another in some way that you're compatible so that you can depend on each other in a mutually reliant way. But also, such a person does not see in the other person to whom he is attached anything bad that perhaps exists and makes him not to be a true or genuine guide. This person he relies on and depends on and is bound up with and complies to the letter in all details. This happens because this man cannot stand on his own two feet. That's why there is this unhealthy compliance. Now, this expression, stand on his own two feet, we'll have to come back to that, because it doesn't mean depending on yourself rather than God, which we could misunderstand it to mean. He cannot see other human beings with love as a separate personality, or be moved toward them with true love and come into a true relationship with them. This man seeks to be liked in a compulsive way. Please like me, I will comply with you. In a morbid and sick way, he seeks love, approval, support, protection, and if they are lacking, not only can he not find any peace, not only can he not calm down, but he feels as if he's lost. He feels as if he's sinking into chaos. We feel rejected. We've made an effort to be accepted, and we've kind of offered some compliance, and then we get upset because we don't get any acknowledgement. That's the kind of unhealthy compliance we're talking about. The moment that such a person goes to break away, he sees that something is slipping away under his feet, something he's been depending on, and he's sinking into chaos and feels as though he's going to be destroyed, and may even actually be true. Next point, page 45. Such a person of moving toward others in unhealthy compliance, is ready to do the most difficult, the most humiliating jobs, things that someone might be amazed to see him doing, so that something unhealthy can be preserved, something in no way pleasing before God. And you know, I can think back to the beginning of my relationship with Sharon. You know, you start out not knowing how to love another person. You learn over the course of time. Very romantic feelings to begin with, idealization of the other person, almost a kind of and it's involved with this moving toward others, I think. Offering something and hoping that love is returned. And, you know, when we first start out, we do that sort of thing. Laying our heart down before someone, you know, hoping that it doesn't get trampled on. And if it does, you know, then of course, you know, we're brokenhearted. It's not a healthy way to love, but we do the best we can when we start out. Such a person feels subconsciously and deeply within himself that he needs love, this unhealthy love. He also thinks that other human beings are in need and runs to them as a helper, but certainly in an unhealthy way. I'm sorry, but that's the way it is. This person is most eager to run from one human being to another who is in need, not out of real love. And so we have, in our youth, some very unfortunate relationships with other people when we're in this kind of condition. Something basic, going down to the bottom of this next paragraph, is lacking in him. What is lacking? What's lacking is a knowledge of God, an experience of God, loving God, experience of God's love for us, and that can't come without humility. Pride is involved in all this sort of thing. Offering obeisance is a kind of hope that there is going to be some control that comes out of this offering of unhealthy compliance. Elder Simeon points out very soon. But in each one of these cases, moving toward others in a way of unhealthy compliance, moving against them in an effort to dominate, and moving back out of fear, each one of them is a different way of trying to control others, trying to define ourselves in terms of others in an unhealthy way. A lot of this is summary again, different kind of summary than the one we did last week. Page 47, just after the heading, let us not hesitate. If then you understand why we aren't making any progress despite our putting in a certain effort and how much hard work gets lost, if then what we are saying is how things are at the bottom, and I repeat, I believe that it is, and I gave you my reasons, then we must not hesitate, we must not fear, we must not slack off and make a spiritual effort not to act in this unhealthy way. Again, in more simple language, maybe less confusing language, as Metropolitan Jonah would say, do not resent, do not react, keep inner stillness. Inner stillness is that place where we are standing on our own two feet. Not by relying on ourselves, but by humbly being in the presence of God or standing before God in the appropriate way, which enables us to stand before others in the appropriate way. We keep our stillness, we don't resent, we don't react, we don't move toward them in an unhealthy way of compliance. We don't try to dominate them out of fear. We don't try to back off out of fear, separate ourselves. And we keep this inner stillness. Now, we may not have this inner stillness. Okay, for the most part, we don't. We may have some sense of it, though. Elder Simeon is developing a kind of vocabulary, a spiritual vocabulary, for us at a practical level, it seems to me, so that when we consider how we have been and how we generally are with others and how we even are with God, we can become more aware. This is his effort, to make us more conscious of the way we are with God and the way we are with others is not the way of holiness. And what we need to do is to not be tempted to try to control the situation or others or God in one of these three ways that is actually a trap, you know, and makes us distant from God and others. And then finally, page 48, third line down, in the final analysis, each of us is seeking himself, as the fathers say, and we'll find ourselves, but to our own perdition. What he means is, I think, that we will find a way of being and living that is less than the way we ought to be before God and others. In other words, you know, and this has come up before, and some people have been here sometimes, some they haven't, so it's kind of hard to hold things together, but the object that we all have in mind is to find some way of feeling whole and strong and functional in society without actually having any knowledge of God, love of God, experience of God. And if we don't have that, then we can't have that with other people either. So we try to take what we've got and the strategies that we've used in dealing with others, whichever one has worked best for us, and we use the other two too, and we're after a sense of wholeness, essentially without God. You know, we even distance ourselves from God by treating him as though maybe he's a resource in our project of feeling whole, separate from an actual humility before God and a proper stance before God and others. That's what's going on here. Because when one seeks the love of others in a sick way, including love of God in a sick way, then he seeks to satisfy his selfishness, as the fathers say. We are seeking our own. And we keep finding ourselves, but up to our own destruction, and also for the harm of others. So we find ways of functioning that are not healthy, but work for us in a way that separates us from God and others, but at the same time, it gives us some sense of stability, separate from others, separate from God. So that's how we function. We all do this, and we use these three strategies in order to do it. Okay. Let's see if I have any more flowers here. Oh, there's another flower, page 53. It isn't possible for Christ to live in such a soul. Why? Because such a person has separated himself from God and others, and fallen into the temptation to try to use these strategies in order to feel whole without an actual knowledge and love of God. It isn't possible for Christ to live in such a soul, according to the verse, it is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. All these strategies are directed toward having a sense of having a life that is my life. That's key, I think. There's a few flowers left. Page 57. What is the person seeking who places a great importance on love in an unhealthy way? To get this love that we need in order to have a sense of myself. You know. Jumping to page 58. Middle of the page, just below the center. Love serves such a type of person because in this way he will be liked by others, and because at the same time he'll feel that he has control over them. There it is. Jumping down to two-thirds of the way through the next paragraph, there's an ulterior motive to be liked by others, to ensure their favor in this way, and to lean on something and support themselves. Use others in any one of those three strategies, kinds of ways, and we can even do this, try to do the same thing with God. Although if we think that we're successful in that, you know, that's our delusion, because God will not actually participate in our effort to use him in that way. It's not really a love of God at all. Okay, page 59 starts here at the bottom. Such a person manages things in a certain way so that the others whom he serves, whom he thinks about, the others whom he seeks love from, and to whom he gives love, for them to be above him, and consequently for him to be in second place, because this is an unhealthy compliance, remember. At the same time, page 60, however, he himself feels that he is above. I don't know, is this passive-aggressive? Kind of sounds to me like a little passive-aggressive. That is, that he himself is the one who has understood the way things actually are, because this is a way that works for me, and so this is the way I'm dealing with other people. Okay, so that was my effort to follow a theme through the chapter that we did not touch on before, it didn't seem to me. But I'm going to use that for the introduction for this week, and then we'll move on to the new material, page 67. So, any coherency out of that? You know, I was trying to follow a particular line of thought, and then I'm hoping that it made some sense.
It seems to me that what strikes me about that, and really about all of these, is that their attempts to live out a life that is not possible to live out because it's not based in reality. It's based in something that can't last because it's a delusion. So that, you know, kind of a sad state of things that most of us are living in some level or the other of delusion. And for the most part, we're, you know, deep into it.
Well, we are, because the only one who is living the reality of a real life is someone who is making the spiritual effort to be oriented toward God and move away from self-love and toward him. It's the spiritual path. If we're not doing that, then we are in a state of delusion, because there is no other alternative but to be one with God and with others by way of our oneness with him. The more that increases, just orienting ourselves in the right direction and moving a little bit. We are on the beam. We're dealing with reality. We're not trying to make it up and make it center around us. So we may not be very far along the path, but if we're on the path and we're headed in the right direction, we're struggling against the delusions that tempt us. So that's, I think, an encouraging.
That's encouraging, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We get more and more awareness of how things are and what we have to deal with as they come up and challenge us from that unconscious level, you might say. You know, and every encounter with another human being is going to be another opportunity. They will come up, like the tides of the natural world, you know, or storms. You know, I mean, you can count on them coming up, and then you just you deal with them. A holy person will be able to walk across the waters of chaos, no matter what's going on outside of them. We are brought down by everyone. You know, the more we are aware, the less we are at the mercy of inner storms, the bad weather of our soul, more or less. Okay. What do you think, Steve?
I think I feel like I'm always in the storm. I really do.
Well, it's one thing to be aware of the fact that there's a storm going on. It's another thing to be so at the mercy of the storm that we have no awareness and we're totally caught up by the storm and just unconsciously being blown this way and that. So.
Well, I know it didn't mention false humility, but it seems to me if you have love from God, you would, like you said, not be tossed around by the chaos around you. It would be inside you.
I think he does mention that.
But I think the false humility, like some of these things that you read mentioned, you know, it sounds like manipulation.
Right.
Sounds like, you know, it's all kind of centered around ourselves.
Yes.
I think that, I don't know what I'm trying to...
Well, the sad thing about false humility is it doesn't help you.
Yeah, and maybe we're...
You may convince people that you're humble. You may even convince yourself that it's humble.
Right.
But God knows you're not. Mm-hmm. It's not reality. So it's not going to make any difference.
Yeah.
It's just part of your bad situation. So false humility, you know, it's not showing off for people to be humble. It's a hidden reality between you and God, you know, essentially.
A long time ago, I heard someone say that humility isn't necessarily just making yourself low.
Right.
It's dealing with things the way they actually
are. Yes, yes. And this person who's just making themselves low, that's unhealthy compliance that we're talking about as moving toward. Yeah.
Can you?
I'm amazed. You know, to just jump through like that.
Can you explain, but he mentioned it a couple times. The worksheet, which I pronounced, I'm not sure who. But anyway, just standing on your own 2 feet. What is that? I mean, I don't want to.
Yeah, no, that's the hardest thing.
But
let me describe. Let me give you. This is a quotation from Elder Simeon from another source. I've been going through the internet and collecting them. Spiritual work happens secretly in the heart. Externally, let everything else threaten us. Like the sea, the wind blows, the waves rise, but deep down it's all quiet, peaceful, serene. This is how a man who trusts in God lives. Such a person is standing on their own 2 feet. God intends for us to be free. That doesn't mean free to do whatever our passions tell us. It means free of control by our passions, free of unconscious control of these urges to try to function without God and in fear of or intention to control others. That's not freedom. We're compelled to do what we do. I've thought about referring to this, and I'm not sure it's proper, but there was a time recently. There is a way to pray where you are just calm, not just praying by rote or just doing the duty of doing your prayers, but just kind of calmly being in the presence of God, knowing that, you know, there's a place where, is it St. John Chrysostom says that when you pray before icons, don't stare at the icon. Be aware of the fact that Christ is there. The icon is there, and you are standing in the presence, not of an icon, but standing in the presence of Christ. The icon is the physical likeness of God, and you are physically standing in the presence of God. Don't stare at it. You look down from it and just let it be a presence. If we just let God be the presence that we are standing before without a passionate desire to have something from Him, or without, I don't know, boredom, just calmly focusing on the prayer that we are offering to God in His presence, we can experience what's being described here, at least briefly, in our prayer. Because all that really is being referred to, when you think about it, is the proper stance before God. We can pray humbly. It's possible for us to do that. It's possible for us to cut off any desire that comes up to manipulate God or want God to do something for us, something other than humbly asking that He give us the humility, the greater, the deeper humility that we need. We can experience that without being a saint. I think it is an experience that we can have. It's not such a strange thing. We sometimes have at least experienced this kind of peace. and serenity in prayer, even if briefly we've experienced it, hopefully. And if not, expect that it can be so. Try to bat away the things that prevent it, because it's our natural state. This is, I think, a critical thing. Somewhere, where was I reading recently? I don't remember where it was, that we have to remember that it is our natural condition to stand before God as the beings that He has created, without pride, without being upset or angry at others. Those storms can calm if we let them. If we don't throw gasoline on the fire will die. Like any passion, we can wait it out. Go before God in prayer and let things calm. Use the Jesus prayer, whatever you need to do. And it's not like we are trying to accomplish something that we don't have the capacity yet, and we're trying to gain some capacity that we don't have. The point is that God created us in such a way that it is natural for us to be at one with Him. We are Christians. We have repudiated a love and a faith in the world. You know, I repudiated a faith in ourselves. Now all we've got to do is try to be consistent, maybe at least in this one moment, in prayer. And that is the standing on your own two feet. Not self-reliant, as though God give me the ability to dominate and win, you know, in my worldly life. And we would think from a worldly point of view, that's what standing on your own two feet means. But that's not what it means. This. It means this. And it was a good question to ask it. There might be a wild rage out there, but deep down nothing hinders the soul from having mystical communion with God, mystical love for God, quietly and mystically in a special way that the heart perceives the Lord is whispering, if we can quiet ourselves. Don't be afraid. I am here. Keep walking this path. Keep loving me. Keep believing in me. Keep following me. For us to have right communion with Christ, which in this book he calls the proper stance before God, it is necessary that our entire soul becomes conscious, that it comes into the light. And this could be gradual. You know, when the sun comes up, you sit and wait for the sun to come up over the horizon down at the beach, and you're waiting, and it's just a little bit of glow, and the next thing you know, there it is. It comes up gradually, and yet at the same time, all of a sudden, it just kind of seems to pop up. It's an unusual thing, and I know there's a scientific explanation for why it looks like that, but that's not the point. Our entire soul gradually becomes conscious, or at least more conscious. It's better than sinking down into the darkness. It's the opposite. It comes into the light, into the grace of God, and that eventually nothing remains in darkness for the holy person, the saint. However, no matter how much someone believes, no matter how much he every day makes a new start in the true life and struggles to give himself and devote himself to God, he must realize this vital point, that within him, the ego, pride, and selfishness live and rule. Do we know ourselves? This is what we learn to realize about ourselves and accept that it is the case, and to work not to be dominated by that. This self-love, this self-worship lives and reigns. If that is our condition, we will not be able to stand on our own two feet. Therefore, man must become humble. Every day he must increase in humility. He who truly loves humility and desires to become humble begs God for this in this way, in the beginning and imperceptibly, gradually lighter, later perhaps more truly. He starts little by little to feel this, the emptying of the soul from the ego, from selfishness, from the idol which we have installed within us. The ultimate point in this book will be that we create an idealized image and believe in that, and that's who we think we are. This book is intended to blast that unconscious bondage to serving that idealized image. So consciousness is necessary, and if we don't have it, the fact that we don't will block any possibility of spiritual movement. That's the ultimate point of this book. There are psychological problems in the spiritual life, things that are blocks. So he's trying to show you how we can become aware of that the blocks even exist in the first place. Because if we don't, how are we going to do anything? We just won't do anything. Yeah. Well, we're kind of being in that position. Okay. There's more here that's helpful, but it's not so much to your point, so I'm going to stop there. I think this is the most difficult thing, is to get a sense of that. And the reason it's difficult is because it's a matter of experience. I mean, we can develop an idea of it, but if we have had no experience of it whatsoever, I think maybe at the beginning we're just going to have to take it on faith that there is such an experience possible. And if we turn toward God and move in that direction, it will come. Maybe a little bit. I mean, don't expect the uncreated light, you know. But something. Because it's in our nature. The way we actually have been created. It's not something that's foreign to us, that we have to accomplish, that we didn't have. God, He has made us in such a way that that is how we are. And it's all this other crap that gets in the way. You know? So we get that stuff out of the way, we will be able to be as God created us to be. Just the beginning part, anyway. I mean, not all of a sudden. So, any other questions on what I tried to pull out of that chapter? Okay, thank you. Thank you for putting up with that effort. I wasn't sure I wanted to try to do that, but okay. Okay, so page 67. New chapter, chapter 3, moving against people. As I've mentioned before, and 3 or 4 pages, for those who count as 2 sides, it would be 6 pages. In Horney's book, her section on moving against people is the same length as her chapters on the other 2 strategies. I don't know. I mean, I suggested last time that maybe the reason that there are only 3 pages or 6 pages on this strategy is that from a Christian point of view, it's obvious that this strategy is not one we ought to be using. But we do. We all do. We all do. Some of us rely on it more than others. All of us have figured out how to blend these 3 so that they work best for us. So, okay. Actually, there's only these few pages, but part of this, a big chunk of it, in the beginning is introduction and review. Man isn't an individual. I think that's hard to think. Man isn't an individual. Now, I am an individual. I'm me. I'm not you. I'm not any of the rest of you. None of you are me. But to be human is not, I am not human all by myself. I need others in order to be human. That's the kind of being God created when He created human beings. You know, there was a whole section on this earlier in the book, which you weren't here, but and you don't have a copy, which, you know, and I gave away the last copy the other week. But there is a, you know, and I again will offer to Xerox that part, send it to you if you want, because it's a good part. Okay. I might need to be reminded. But anyway, man was created in God's image, remember. And God is Father, Son, Holy Spirit. One God, 3 persons. Human beings are one, we would say, kind of being. But he wants to say, or Elder Simeon wants to say, man is one being. See, we're so used to thinking of ourselves as, I am a human being without anyone else. If I were the last person on earth, I would be a human being. I would be in a lot of trouble because I'd be, then it really would be me and you, God. And the part of the point is here that if I have a me and you, God kind of relationship with God, then I am moving toward Him. I have an unhealthy compliance relationship with Him because I am an isolated individual trying to deal with God without all the rest of humanity. And even, I would say, even if I were the last man on earth, I still will not be the only person who has ever lived. I still will be a member of the human being. We would say species, but I would still be a human being among other human beings, even if all the rest of those human beings were no longer living at the same time that I'm living. That's how connected I am to other human beings. I cannot be human in isolation all by myself. And I am contradicting, and Elder Simeon is contradicting, and the Orthodox Christian faith contradicts the contemporary secular idea that one human being is the ultimate unit of being human. We're saying that's not true. It's not that way in Scripture. It's not that way in Genesis. Our spiritual nature is such that none of the things that are taught to us about spiritual life would make any sense at all if that were the case. That is an idea, the rise of individualism, that has a history that you could trace. You could do a course on the history of the rise of the very unusual idea that human beings are individual beings, that each one is a monad, a one being unto themselves. There is no such being. There actually is no such being. The devil wants to be a being like that. But he's not. God is not such a being. God is not a monad. God is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Three persons, one God. And human beings are not such beings. There is one human being. Then one, this gets kind of philosophical to say, but this is the way of being human. The way of being human is such that all of us together are human being. This is how we were created. That's what he means by saying man isn't an individual. Just as God the Father isn't alone, where the Father is, there is also the Son, there is also the Holy Spirit. The deity is one, but with respect to persons, God isn't a monad, but three persons, and in this way there exists a communion of love, and human beings are created in the image and likeness of God. We are not divine, we are created, but we are what we are as human together. Love your brother as yourself. The Old Testament rabbinical meaning was not love yourself and love others the same way you love yourself. The Old Testament meaning was, and this is Jesus' way of thinking, love the other person as yourself because the other person is yourself. You are yourself by being together with the other person. And I have some notes from a recording that Bishop Callistos Ware did. It's a series called The Human Person in Orthodox Spirituality, Who Am I? Who Are We? Which we want to know who we are. I can only discover who I am by realizing that I am myself along with others. And Bishop Callistos says, it is impossible to understand a human person apart from God. Humans cut off from God are no longer authentically human. And humans cut off from other human beings are not authentically human either. This is an aberration to be cut off from God and cut off from others. This is exactly the condition, the experience of the fall. The reality hasn't changed. The reality of our humanity is not changed. Our natural nature is still what God created it to be. It can't change. But our anxiety lies in the fact that we do not experience a oneness with God and others because of having turned away from the source of life into the world, and we're trying to create ourselves using the stuff of the world. So, we are not self-contained. I do not contain my meaning within myself, Bishop Callistos says. There is a kenonia of being human, a communion, a union of persons. There is no true person unless there are at least two persons. I need you to be myself. All meaningful action is for the sake of friendship. And you can remember back to our last book where the meaning of Christian friendship is a common effort to grow in purity of heart. So it's a self-realization. You want to find yourself? Find someone to find yourself along with. You know, this is why we get married. This is why we have friends. As parents, our children, this is what the main thing they need to learn, is that there is a, and then they will be able to stand on their own two feet spiritually. There's a point where Elder Simeon talks about how, if we're not careful, we can raise children so that they are dependent on us in a way that is spiritually not good. And it may seem ironic to us, especially as American individualists, but the fact of the matter is that if we have a oneness within the family, amongst the members of the family, it will strengthen the members of that family so that when those children grow to be 21 years old, they will be able to go out on their own and not be attached to their parents in an unhealthy way. That's standing on your own two feet. That's the kind of thing that we're talking about. Because a time of the development of a common effort toward purity of heart and friendship that's supposed to happen, you know, in family life, in marriage, in friendship, in parish life. Okay. The characteristic human word is not I, but we. The Lord's Prayer, Bishop Calestos points out, uses us 5 times, our 3 times, we once, and does not use I 1 time. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. We pray as not separated from others. How else would the Son of God encourage us to pray? I mean, the whole point is to be one with the Father through the Son in the Holy Spirit. Why would I commit to it that separates us? And we don't need to be worried about getting sucked up into the Borg, you know. we talked about that last time, you know, maybe not enough. I don't know. It's an interesting thing to talk about, though. Because, you know, with the Borg, and see, now, are you familiar with Star Trek? The Borg? Is that a little bit? See, I'm telling you, you need a course in Star Trek. I have such a book, but at any rate, we won't do Star Trek this week. Okay. There's a good example here of the kind of oneness that a holy person, for example, St. John Maximovich in this case, St. John that the church down in downtown Atlanta was named after St. John Maximovich, a 20th century saint who was a holy man. And there is a story about one of his spiritual children who had gone to bed and was just thrashing around in agony trying to deal with some problem that was really troubling him. And St. John called him on the telephone, 3 o'clock in the morning, and St. John said to him, "You won't solve your problems by sitting up and worrying. Why don't you just go to bed?" He knew that one of his children was suffering. There are a lot of examples of Elder Paisios doing similar things, of his awareness of the agony and the troubles of his children, of his spiritual children. In this case, St. John Maximus. So there is this kind of oneness that we have with one another that is not recognized by us because of the way we are divided from God and from others. But the reality is that this is how God has created us. We think of a holy person and the things that they can do that are so spiritually spectacular as miraculous and unusual events that are separate from the natural order of things. The actual way things are is that the way we are is unnatural. That's, I think, a big recognition. You know? So it's like we need to get all of the baloney out of the way, the self-love, the using these strategies to try to build a sense of wholeness for ourselves or a sense of an idealized image of ourselves. We stop doing that and let the fact that God has already created us deal with that reality in a spiritually humble way, and gradually the clouds part. God has created things in a good way, you know. Okay. I think that's good. Oh, there is a note here that's kind of related to the Borg thing. Theosis, a union without confusion. Our human nature is not abolished. Once a holy person, St. John the Maximovich or St. Elder Paisios, when they become more and more at one with God, like God, it doesn't abolish our human nature. How could it? We're always going to be created. We don't have to worry about it. We are not going to become one with the divinity of God as God's divinity. That's not because we're created beings. It's just not something we need to worry about. We will always just be human. And it's good. It's good. Our human nature is not abolished. The model is Christ, who has 2 natures and is 1 person. Our human personhood is not lost in God, the way the individual personhood of Seven of Nine was lost in the Borg until she got picked up by Picard and gradually was separated from this hive mind of the Borg and became more and more conscious of herself as an individual. And the key to the Star Trek thing, as I pointed out before, is that for Gene Roddenberry, personhood and individuality are the same thing. And that's what we're denying. So that's the key to that conundrum, you know, about Star Trek. Okay, conversation?
Well, it brings up a lot of conversations we had early on in our, Mike probably remembers some of this, in our conversion into orthodoxy and some of the discussions we had about, you know, becoming like Christ, losing ourselves in Christ actually has to do with becoming more like who we really are. And I'm getting that also from Lewis. I mean, Lewis, it's the same thing. You hear a lot about it. You know, you see in the Screwtape letters where the demons try to get people to feel bad about having any particular taste or any, you know, liking a certain thing. Make them feel that that's wrong, that they should be. No, but it isn't. That's not the way. You know, the more we become like Christ, the more we die to ourselves, the more we really have the opportunity to become ourselves. And what we mean by die to ourselves is really die to those passions that make us, as you point out, so common and base.
Different from what we actually are.
Yes.
Separated from what we are, from what God created us as. Right.
The other thing I remember, it seems like Bishop, at the time, Bishop Samuel, said something about, we say this, you know, well, I'm only human. But what we really should say is, I'm subhuman.
Right.
You know, we're not quite human.
Right.
What we're trying to do is become human.
Right.
And the reality is we have fallen short of the glory of God.
Right.
Or, you know, the glory of Christ, which is to be fully human. Of course, he's to be fully God and fully man.
Yeah, Lewis's famous sermon, The Weight of Glory, mm-hmm. you know, is all about that. I wish he'd done more sermons. I thought I'd discovered one the other week, but I found out it's not a sermon. It's like a short essay that eventually became part of God in the Dock. It wasn't a sermon. I was
That's
disappointed.
The one you have to send me.
No, I haven't sent. You might have to prompt me.
Okay.
Second paragraph, middle of the second paragraph. Man was not created as one person. That is me. It's always me, you know. Reminds me of something that I would really like to talk about would be a complete waste of time.
A lot of the things I really want to talk about are a complete waste of time.
It's tough to recognize them when they pop up. Today, individuality is devouring us. It came from the West, and it's something frightful. And day by day, this individualistic spirit enters our country more and more. He's not talking about us Americans. He's talking about the danger that we are to his country, you know, to Greece.
In other words, we were already there.
We're where it came from. You know, this individualism, because, I mean, individualism is what we believe in. And although I would defend the Founding Fathers on this, I think we are a lot worse that way than they were. I mean, yes, they had some... They were confused about religion, basically. They did a good job, you know, the things that they did. But when it comes to religion, they were a mess. And it was a generational thing. I mean, you can't expect any generation to be perfect. You know, to deal with all the problems. They did a lot. I mean, respect them for what they did. But realize that when it came to religion, Jefferson was a sad case, you know. Cutting up the Bible and cutting out all the miracles, you know. No, this is not good. This is not an advance. Even within the family, one feels completely isolated. Oh, don't we? I mean, we're all expected to go through that as teenagers. You don't understand me, you know. Me, how could anybody understand you? You don't even kind of even exist in that way as a human being, you know. So, I mean, do you understand you? I have to go find myself, you know. There you are, you idiot. You're sitting right in front of me, you know. That's where you are, you know. Oh, well. So we've all been through that. One doesn't realize from his root, from the depth of his existence, that he is together with others. He doesn't feel this. Therefore, man isn't by himself, but is together with others. We can't escape it. God created us that way. You know, I mean, even if we don't feel it, it is the reality. If one doesn't take a correct position before other people, we ought to have some inkling of what he means by that at this point. He certainly won't have a good and smooth spiritual development, and someday he'll be blocked inside and come into conflict with other people. Consequently, one needs to take the correct position before other people. If a person doesn't take the correct position before other people, he can move toward them in three ways. We've been over them again and again, so I'm not going to review them yet another time. Although, the way he does says this, and maybe this would be, I'm going to skip that part because we'll get back into the soup, and we just got out of it. Page 69, heading, with love, we situate ourselves correctly before others, but not love in the sense of inappropriately glomming ourselves onto somebody, object being control of a certain kind of underhanded way. We don't not love by trying to dominate them, not love by, you know, we'll get to the third kind later, but with the kind of love that God has for us and a love that we can have if we really are facing God and moving toward him and forgetting about ourselves and being humble in his presence, then we will understand the kind of love that God has for us. We will love him and we will be able to love others. We have to love somebody first. It may not be God. In my case, it was Sharon. And although I had a great sense that I had the whole ball of wax at the time, I would tell her things like, I know you better than you know yourself. I would tell her how much I love her. I was 17 years old. I was full of self-love. It was narcissism. It was this inappropriate compliance. It was all messed up, but I was sincere. Now, of course, who is it? Lewis says, somebody else says, you know, the devil is sincere. So sincerity will not take you far. You know, but I was, and I was wanting to be able to love this person. I'll say that. There was definitely a movement outside of myself to a certain degree. The sun comes up slowly out of the darkness, you know. I thought I had it. I thought I was all it. That's the key. Yes, I thought I was all it. You know, what I am giving to you, this love I've got for you, how can you refuse? How can you even think about not, you know, acknowledging this? You know, no one has ever loved you the way I love. Are you kidding? I mean, this is sickening, you know. I mean, if you weren't 17, nobody could forgive you for it. But fortunately, you have the sense to fall in love with somebody who is also 17. You know, so they're not sure what's going on, but, you know, well, he says this. I mean, who knows? You know, she has always thought I was a little nutty, you know, because, well, she didn't think so highly of herself. So what is the matter with this guy saying these things about me? I know I'm not worth anything. 17 is tough. It's tough. We're all a mess. Okay. All problems proceed from these three movements a person makes in relation to his fellow men. Okay. Didn't even get through these three pages. We could try. Or shall we stop?
We probably should stop.
No, we will stop.
It was very good, though.
Okay, good.
Thanks for the nuts.
Yeah, these are exceptional nuts. They must have something in here that is especially delicious that probably causes cancer. These are about the best nuts I've ever had.
Really?
Yeah, they have a real good taste.
It's our CVS brand.
Huh? How about those?
They want sale.
Mm-hmm. Are those also CVS?
Mm-hmm. Gold Emblem is CVS brand. Huh. I think, isn't it? I'm pretty sure.
We have a good crop this year, man.
Okay, and if I promised anyone anything that they haven't gotten, you'd send me an email, and I will respond.